Welcome in to the Towel Boys. He's Mike Romala from RunRevs.com. I'm Tyler Bischoff over here at Mountain West Connection. And, Mike, we're all jumping aboard the three-point train, aren't we?
That's what it seems like.
Tyrell Bellot Green, no clue if that's how you pronounce his actual name. It might be below. I have no idea. 6'7", forward from Hill College, a junior college in Texas. Is he like officially committed? I don't know. He said on Twitter he's coming to UNLV. He chose UNLV over Colorado State. He's like 48-50% three-point shooter in this 2 years there. Let's see. Last year he averaged almost 15 points and 6 rebounds. His freshman year he averaged almost 12 points and 6.5 rebounds, so might be a decent rebounder. I think they went 27-2 last year, or maybe it was the year, one of the 2 years he was there, they went 27-2 and they lost a game by 2 points and they lost a game in triple overtime. So they were Hill College, apparently pretty good junior college, at least one of the last 2 years. Does Dave Rice have too many wings now, Mike?
I don't think that it's possible to have too much shooting anyways. I think you always want as many options as you can. And when it comes to people that can actually make shots, that's something that they've lacked in recent years. So if they're going to go overboard recruiting certain types of players, I think that's one area that they probably should lean towards getting more of it as opposed to less of it.
Neither one of us know a whole lot about this guy other than his stats. I mean, really, that's it. He's 6'7". He shot the three really well at junior college. And he grabbed 6 rebounds a game 2 straight years. That's like literally all either of us know about him. So I have no clue where he projects into playing for UNLV. But if you've got a guy, and even if the step up in competition made his 3-point percentage fall by 10%, and now he's a 40% 3-point shooter, that's still really good. And you know, it's almost like you have to play this guy unless he is a defensive liability. And especially if he can
rebound. For his size, exactly. If you look at just the measurables, he's 6'7", 225 pounds. So it's not like he's a skinny guy either. I mean, the ideal, you're hoping, if you're a UNLV fan, you're hoping that he is big enough to play, to defend threes and fours defensively while like pulling them away from the basket with his shooting on offense. That's what you're hoping for.
Dave Rice, he just tries to get as many guys in that 6'6 to 6'9 region, doesn't he?
I don't know anything about this guy athletically. I don't know if he's if he's quick. I don't know if he's got long arms. I don't know if he's a bruiser. All I know is that he makes half of his 3-point shots, and the 3-point line is the same distance as it's going to be at UNLV next year. So I can't speak to like his length or whatever. But yeah, he fits into that mold of this type of guys they seem to be recruiting.
If we look at the players on the roster next year. So it's they still have one open scholarship, but I don't expect it to be anybody that's going to play necessarily. Like, it could be Justin Jackson. I guess he could play, but it could be a guy they bring in that redshirts. I don't know. But if we look at the current roster, forwards in terms of big guys, you got 3 in Zimmerman, Okunobo, Carter, and then you've got guys like Morgan, possibly Bellot Green, Derek Jones that can slide down and play some 4. At point guard, you'll have Seegers, you'll have Poyser, you'll have Cook, and I think Pat McCaw is going to be the second, if not the best, point guard on the team next year, but might not actually play a ton of minutes there because Seegers is there. And then on the wing, which is where sort of the log jam is, you have Ike Wamu, Pat McCaw, Jordan Corners, Dwayne Morgan, Derek Jones, Jalen Poyser might not play at all there, and Tyrell Bellot Green. Between the 2 and the 3, which is where most of those guys play, there's 80 minutes in a basketball game. I'm of the belief that McCaw and Wamu are your 2 best players, so they should be playing 30 minutes a game each, maybe a little less. But all of a sudden, you've got 30 minutes to distribute between Jordan Cornish, Dwayne Morgan, Derek Jones, and Tyrell Bellot Green. I'll ask it this way. Who the hell's transferring at the end of next year?
You're giving 2 positions as wing positions. What I'm going to suggest is that maybe we see 3 wings on the floor for significant time next year. With the Rebels going small, I think you may see a lot of one point guard, 3 wings, Zimmerman at center, which would be like your small ball run the floor lineup. And then you've got more minutes to give a guy like Cornish or a guy like Jones or below Green if you think he's going to be able to play some four. I think that just looking at the way that the roster is shaking out right now, I mean, do you have to give Ben Carter a ton of minutes at the four? Do you have to give Okonobo a ton of minutes at the five? If they want to go small, if your best players are wing players, I don't think you can sit them just because of you want to play a traditional lineup. If you want to get your best players on the floor and the best lineup on the floor, ideally. If that ends up being a smaller lineup with three wings, I think you'll see them do that.
I hope we see that. Like, I hope their five best players are, like, all guards and Zimmerman or something like that. But I haven't seen Derek Jones, Jalen Poizer, Below Green. I haven't seen these guys play. I've seen Dwayne Morgan play. Wasn't all that special. I'm not convinced that they're all going to be good enough to take minutes away from Okonobo.
That's the other thing. Like, there's no guarantee that these guys are going to be, you know, pushing to break into the rotation or to break into the starting lineup. They have 12 guys right now. Are all 12 of them going to be starting caliber? Probably not.
For some reason, because I think Matt Eumanns at the Review Journal and Taylor Byrne at the Sun, I've read stuff from them this offseason, and they've both kind of slotted in Ike Wamu and Pat McCaw as shooting guards, and they've slotted Dwayne Morgan as a small forward. And my question is kind of with positions and Pat McCaw, and I think he's the best point guard on the team. If we get to a point, how likely do you think that Rice would be to say, okay, Seegers, like, we're better off if McCaw runs the point and we can get these other guys some minutes, and Seegers kind of takes a back seat being a backup point guard? Like, how likely do you think that is after 10, 15 games?
That Patrick McCaw outplays Seegers as a point guard and that their best lineup features McCaw at the point? I think that's likely.
Not that that happens, but that Dave Rice, like, lets that happen. That he says, okay, Seegers, you're going to play 10 minutes a game. Yeah.
I mean, it depends on how the season is going. You know, if something happens and they need to make that kind of move, I could see. I mean, I that doesn't seem all that unlikely to me. That's something that's certainly, like, within the realm of imagination. Like, I don't think that would be a surprising move. I don't think anyone would be surprised if McCaw became the starting point guard at some point next year. If he's outperforming Seegers, or if the team is just better with McCaw at the one, I could see it happening. He did it for stretches last year, and he seemed to show some promise. We haven't seen much of Seegers. As you've brought up, he's never been a big-time producer. He's still something of a question mark. You're waiting to see what you're going to get from him. It's not beyond the realm of possibility that McCaw ends up being the point guard and Seegers ends up on the bench.
Tell me why I'm wrong. Dwayne Morgan doesn't have a place in the rotation at all next year.
His defensive versatility, if he takes a step forward, I say his greatest potential is on the defensive end, being able to guard multiple positions. Like, even last year, coaches and even other players were saying, the game is easier for us defensively when Dwayne's out there because we can switch a lot of screens where we don't give up much because he can defend everyone.
As the top man in the 1-3-1.
Like, I'm not saying I'm buying into that. Like, I'm just saying, like, that's you wanted me to tell you how you're wrong. Like, I could see if they want to play defensive lineups, maybe Morgan is one of the five best guys for their defensive lineups.
Okay, so small ball wise, and the reason that I say that is because I don't know what he brings to the team that's much better than the other guys, because if you want to play small and you want to play some of these wings as your four for significant minutes, you don't gain very much if the guy you put as your stretch four can't shoot.
Yeah.
And so, Dwayne Morgan, body type, he fits that four-man role, and it seems like, you know, he might very well be the best defensive stretch four that you have, but you don't gain anything offensively because, I mean, he shoots it worse than Steven Zimmerman from 15 feet. And, you know, he's no better than Goodluck Okonobo from 15 feet. So unless he takes, like, a big step forward offensively, I just, like, I don't know how much he plays next year because I don't think he's going to be one of UNLV's eight best players, nine best players. I mean, I really feel like he's the guy that slides way down the depth chart. Yep. If you've mentioned before, keeping guys happy, and he was the key to the recruiting class last year. But if it's solely a merit-based what you do on the court, I don't really feel like Dwayne Morgan's going to play much next
and
year.
And it's a really good point that you make, that in order to be a stretch four, you have to be able to stretch the defense. You know, the defense has to respect you as an outside shooter. It's something that a problem that they kind of ran into 2 years ago when they played Roscoe Smith at power forward. And I think a lot of people, myself included, were sort of expecting him to be a better, not a three-point shooter, but someone who could step back and shoot jumpers and sort of give you some space on offense. And he turned out to not really be able to do that. Morgan, we saw him, his shooting last year was not good, not good at all. I don't think he's a guy that defenses are going to have to stretch themselves to cover. So does that mean his minutes have to come at the three? Is there going to be much of a point to playing him as a smaller four if he's not going to be able to manipulate the defense in any way?
I'm really excited to see a lineup that's like Pat McCaw, Jordan Cornish, Ike Wamu, Balot Green, and Zimmerman, because I feel like that would be incredible offensively.
What if at 6'7", 225, Balot Green can slide down and play you a little five in super small? Hey, we don't know anything about this guy. Why not? Like, I'll project him playing point guard too, but. Hey,
we can do it. They can do it against. We can see it against Air Force. Do they still have Olashinsky? He might have been their only guy over 6'7" last year.
So, I don't know.
There's so many pieces now, and so like Dave Rice has set himself up to fail, hasn't he?
In what way?
Like just he has so many pieces, and if this next season. He's already under a lot of pressure, we know that. But it's like, he's got so many pieces that he could withstand, like, two guys getting hurt, as long as it wasn't, like, McCaw and Zimmerman or something, mm-hmm. or McCaw and Wamu. Like, he's got so many pieces that if they don't win next year, there's literally no excuse that's not Dave Rice, right?
If you run down the excuses from last year, not that Dave Rice was throwing out excuses, but the things that you heard about the team, you heard that they were young. This team is going to have a lot of veteran players. You heard that they were new, a new group that hadn't played together before. This team's core, that core four sophomores have played together for a year now. They're the face of the franchise. Those guys have all played together. They're going to be deep. They're not going to, you know, they don't, as long as, you know, they don't have any situations where people are transferring three games into the season, like Kendall Smith or multiple guys going out for the season with injuries like Cook and Vaughn and Walker did. It's a deep team, so like those excuses are gone, and it's obviously a really talented team, so talent is not going to be an excuse. So, I mean, for a season that, you know, the expectations, I didn't think we're going to be super high, you know, coming into this year. I mean, they're set up where they've got to probably, you expect this team to make the NCAA tournament.
Because we talked about they've got the two scholarships left, what are we kind of expecting to do? And I didn't really know what to expect. I just said, like, get a big guy because you only have three. Was getting a junior college guy that shoots 50%, like, that's, like, as good as you can do at this point if you're Dave Rice, right?
Yeah, and six-plus rebounds a game. Junior college stats, so who knows. But he's got the size. He's, like I said, 225 pounds. He's not a skinny guy. You know, masquerading as a post player or anything like that. Like, he's legitimately got some muscle, it seems like, and he can shoot it. I don't know, for this late in the process, I think that you probably have to be pretty happy about landing a guy that can make 50% of his three-pointers.
He chose between UNLV and Colorado State, picked to come to Las Vegas. I honestly, don't know him at all, but I'm a little surprised he did pick UNLV, because had he gone to Colorado State, he likely would have been an immediate starter. Like, there's a really good chance, because they lose Avila, they lose Bejarano, they lose Stanton Kidd, who are their three top scorers, or three of their top four scorers from next year. Like, they return Gian Clavel, and Joe DeSimone. Like, those are really the only two names that Colorado State returns next year. They do have a JUCO kid who's like a four-star. They've also got a point guard who's a three-star, and they've got another JUCO from South Plains College, which is in Texas and normally produces some decent players. But like they don't have some great recruiting class coming in, and they don't have super talented guys on the roster from last year. Like, had he gone to Colorado State, there's a really – the path to playing time at Colorado State was much easier. So I was a little surprised. I guess the Matt Stevens, who covers Colorado State, broke it like 2 hours before he actually announced it. But I guess I wasn't super surprised, but just a little bit that he didn't pick Colorado State, just because looking at their roster, it's like, oh, you probably would have played right away, come to UNLV. You might average 2 minutes a game next year.
I mean, from the outside, it's tough to tell, but who knows how he's being recruited. Or maybe he looks at the lineup himself, the roster, and says,
I can beat
maybe he
guys.
Says there's no one there that's scaring me. And maybe, you know, maybe he's that confident that, hey, I can come in and make half my three-pointers, and I'm going to play over these guys. So the thought process I can't really speak to yet. I haven't talked to him yet. I'm hoping to do that sometime soon, but I don't know how the recruiting process went down. But, from the outside, it may seem easier to path the playing time of Colorado State, but, I mean, who knows how it's going to shake out.
All right, so next year expectations, are they – we talked about this right at the end of the year. What do you think they are now? You said NCAA tournament. Is that – you think it's just NCAA tournament?
Well, I think it was when we were talking about when he had this meeting with Tina Kunzer-Murphy, and we were talking about what he has to do to keep his job. I think the expectations, I think I said, you know, NCAA compete for the Mountain West title. I think we both sort of agreed they've got to be in the race, you know, 3 or 4 games left. They've got to have a chance to win the conference. They've got to put a good showing in the postseason. They've got to make the NCAA tournament. I think winning a game in the NCAA tournament would be pretty much that would seal everything. I think most people would be happy with that.
I will still say making the NCAA tournament sort of the low bar or whatever. Yeah. And I said this when we talked about it. If you require a coach to win an NCAA tournament game or win two, you're kind of foolish because of how the NCAA tournament is. But I mean, is it like if you take UNLV fans, if you were talking to a group of UNLV fans and they like all said, hey, this is a Sweet 16 team, on a scale of 1 to 10, how crazy are they?
Well, Sweet 6, if you think your team is a lock for the Sweet 16, that means you've got like a top 6 team in the country, right? Or top 8
yeah.
team to be a
top
lock
eight,
for the Sweet
yeah.
16. So I'd say you're probably around an 8, 7.5 or an 8. That seems pretty – those would be very high expectations.
I was going to say the crazy level would be like 5.5. So, I look at the roster and I say there's a lot of talented pieces. There's a lot of good pieces. There's like a lot of lineups that I say that should really work and they should win a lot of games. But I look at the roster and I see a bunch of freshmen. I see some transfers. I see some guys that have not scored 10 points per game in college, and I just say, you know, a lot of these guys haven't done it in a big way in college, and I'm really hesitant to say, like, yes, they should all live up to their potential. But if they get 7 of these guys to live up to their potential, they should be an NCAA tournament team, and they should be, you know, a 5 or 6 seed in the NCAA tournament. No, like to me, if they get 7 of them to live up to their potential next year, I think that's right where they'll be, if not a little bit better.
I would agree with you. And then the good thing about the way that the team recruits is that the upside is there. Like I think you can look at if you look at just with reasonable expectations, you can see them being a good team. But because the upside that these guys have, say Zimmerman turns out to be, you know, the second coming, and he turns out to be the star freshman who's an impact player right away. Then all of a sudden, your team, the ceiling for the team, you know, jumps significantly. Or say Zimmerman's okay, but Derek Jones is a breakout player who's just dunking on everyone and just tearing it up. Then the ceiling of your team raises a little bit. So, I think that the expectations, right, it's somewhere around, you know, the league competition or the conference title you're competing for, and then making the NCAA tournament. But, you know, there's also potential to have some breakout players and breakout performances that can raise you above that level.
All right. Dave Rice says he wants to press and run again. For entertainment's sake, I hope he's telling the truth. For Pat McCaw's world domination plans, I hope he's telling the truth. But I've been here a year, and I've heard like 37 times that Dave Rice has said this 37 times, and it never happens.
I'm not going to buy it until I see it, like, on the floor. I wasn't here for Dave Rice's first year, but I've been here for the past three, and that seemed like to be a recurring theme, is that, you know, they want to press and they want to run, but like as I said before, I can't see them being that committed to it.
He has to at this point, right? Like, if you look at the lineup, you say this is a team that should, like, play pressure defense. They should have a lot of length. They should be able to run, especially if they play a small lineup with four guys that can handle the ball somewhat. Like, the lineup fits that style of play, right?
Yeah, if you look at it, like, all the pieces are there, but it's a coaching staff that has never coached that style before. So, I mean, asking them to – they didn't do it last year. So asking them to just turn on a dime and all of a sudden become like a run-and-gun team that's pressing you and hounding you and doubling in the backcourt and, you know, creating this tempo game, that it's tough to see a team going from, you know, zero to – well, not zero, but seeing a team go from 15 miles per hour to 60 miles per hour just on the turn of a dime. Like, I can't see that happening until – if maybe they'll prove me wrong, but I don't see it.
I've said before, I think Pat McCaw would – be unbelievable if they just tried to press everybody and ran on offense, because he's great in transition. He's great at creating steals and pressuring. The biggest problem last year defensively was defending guys off the dribble. They didn't have good perimeter defense in terms of letting guys get by them. It didn't kill them because they had pretty good rim protectors. When I look at it defensively, I think they could play a high-pressure defense and take the mentality and the defensive structure to essentially, we're going to pressure you defensively, and if you get by us on the dribble, or when you get by us on the dribble, we are going to try and funnel you to good luck Okonobo waiting at the rim to block your shot. Like, I feel like it might not be perfect, but I feel like that is a plausible and achievable defensive strategy that would make this team a much better defensive team next year, to just try to get steals, and when you don't get them, do everything to funnel them straight to Okonobo.
That's what I would say. Like, even when you say you want to press, people in their head, they picture, you know, Louisville from a couple years ago, you know, trapping in the backcourt and trying to get steals and fast break and, you know, pick sixes going the other way for dunks. But something as simple as UNLV is so long some of these positions, these perimeter positions, just – you know, getting even in the half court, just getting up on the opposing ball handlers and, you know, pressuring them and, you know, gambling for steals and, you know, just trying to disrupt them. If someone blows by you from 30 feet away from the basket, you've got plenty of time to recover or to, like you said, funnel them in a certain direction. You can still catch up on the play from behind. So it doesn't even have to be, you know, full court, up and down, that type of gambling defense. You can just sort of just applying some pressure defensively, I think would help, especially with the kind of roster they got. It's a team that hasn't created turnovers in the past. Turnovers are the best way, the most efficient offensive possessions come off of live ball turnovers. UNLV does not create those kind of possessions because they don't really generate turnovers. But they've got enough long guys, enough athletic guys, and the rim protectors behind them that you would think that even if they don't pressure, you know, full court, they can still, you know, defend the ball and get up and be a little more aggressive and maybe create some turnovers.
Do you think that this team can be smart enough, or Dave Rice can coach it into them, that if they were to play high pressure and in the situations where where a guy gets beat off the dribble, that the other four defenders would understand shot efficiency and not leave a good three-point shooter to take away a guy taking a 10-foot runner or something? Like, do you think they would understand enough, like, okay, let him go to the rim and Okonobo will try to block it. I'm not going to let this 42% guy get an open look.
It would take some time. Like, that, it comes down to, like, coaching, how much time you want to invest. If you want to spend all your preseason preaching defense and practicing those scenarios, and then continue to work on it and tweak it through the season. And you can do that. And then what you see happen with a good coaching staff is the guys who get it, the guys who adapt quickly and understand it quickly, are the guys who end up playing. And the guys who lag a little bit behind and they don't grasp those concepts, they end up not playing. I don't know if we're going to see that. But yeah, I think that's something they could do easily.
Because to me, that would be the key. If they were going to play a half-court, high-pressure defense and try to funnel it to Okanogbo, the key is if their point guard wants to take a runner from just inside the free throw line, let him take that shot. Don't leave the guy that can knock down six threes in a row to get going. Like, to me, that's sort of the key to playing a high-pressure defense offensively in terms of running. I don't know what Seegers brings in that sense. I really don't. I know Pat McCall would be awesome that way. I know Ike Wamu can be awesome that way. I know Jordan Cornish can be a great transition three-point shooter, especially if he's left alone, I guess, unless it's at Colorado State in the last 4 seconds. But Zimmerman, Derek Jones, like, to me, it's like, holy hell, they could throw an alley-oop every four possessions if they actually got out and ran and played high-pressure defense.
They've got a lot of guys. If just looking at the roster on paper, they've got a lot of guys.
I told you I want the Pat McCaw alley-oop counter. Like, he's going to throw an alley-oop on every possession.
You know what? I like the Pat McCaw alley-oops, but what I like even more is the pull-up three-pointers in transition, which he does more than anyone else on the team. Pretty much no one else really does it that much. I'm not talking, you know, coming up in transition and before the defense is set, like getting up. I mean, like racing full speed and just stopping on a dime at the three-point line and just rising up and firing a three-pointer, which he did a bunch of times last year. That's what I like. Like, I could see them doing that. I could see him, like, out on the break, you know, pulling up and hitting threes and then sometimes, you know, driving in and throwing those alley-oops. But they have so many guys who you would think would thrive in that kind of system.
I love the pull-up threes in transition. I know they're not super efficient, but I love them just because I don't say it takes, like, being kind of an idiot, but it's you got to kind of, like, be like, I don't care if I miss. I'm just going to pull up and shoot a three because I want to shoot a damn three.
I once saw Danny Ainge, when he played for the Portland Trailblazers, pull up on a 1-on-0 fast break. He had a breakaway. Pulled up for three and hit it. And this is just some random, like, Saturday afternoon game that I was watching, you know, when I was a kid. And it's always stuck with me because I've never seen anyone else do it.
No layups. No thank you. Just get it three. It's more points. You got to score as many points as possible.
That takes a lot of chutzpah. You get a 1-on-0. You pull up and launch a three? Come on.
Always, always. I think, I'm pretty sure when I covered Marshall Henderson, he did that a couple times. But I think he would take the layups if he had a layup, but I think if they were losing in the last minute, he would do that all the time. Like, all right, I'm shooting a three, even if we're down by, you know, even if a layup is much more, efficient or whatever. But, all right, we got a new segment that's essentially going to be the bullet points of the show.
What's it called?
It's going to be called Curling the Stash, which I think is what my suggestion for the name of the whole podcast was.
Okay.
But basically, this is going to be bullet points of all UNLV sports news. Mike, we'll probably talk some football on here at some point in time.
Okay.
I would assume. Maybe not a whole lot, but football, baseball, and I do play-by-play for all the small sports, so you're going to get some random softball news, although softball's over, baseball and track and golf are like the only things left, so that won't last long. But basically, bullet points of the show. We'll start with baseball. They got swept by Fresno State. They're at San Jose State to end the regular season. They trail Air Force by 2.5 games for the 5 seed in the Mountain West tournament. Air Force goes to Nevada Reno, who's won the conference already. The reason you want to be the 5 seed is because the 6 and 7 seed have a play-in game just to get into the double elimination portion of the tournament. So, if you're the 6 or 7 seed, you could end up playing 8 games in 5 days, which doesn't seem like fun. So UNLV's got to win basically all 3 times. Air Force has to lose all 3 times for UNLV to avoid that play-in game. Also, the baseball team, they just announced it. They're having a new $2.75 million facility out sort of on the right field side of their stadium. Was donated by the Marnell family, who I think is like the owners of the M Resort or something like that. So they're going to have a nice little two-story facility with indoor batting cages and weightlifting and offices and stuff like that. Softball, their season's over, but they will probably have two players on the All-Mountain West team because they had it's so weird in softball because you have girls that hit like 530. And I'm always like, that seems insane, but it's not that insane when girls hit 530 in softball.
But every time I watch softball, it's someone is throwing a no-hitter. Like, who are these people that are getting all these hits? Every time I watch it, it's extremely low scoring and no one can even make contact.
So here's what happens in college softball.
Not to generalize the entire sport, but I kind of just did.
No, it's perfectly fine because in college softball, the really good teams have those pitchers that throw 13 no-hitters in a season. And in the Mountain West doesn't have those really good teams. Like Fresno State's pitcher's really good, but I don't even think she's thrown a no-hitter this year. But she's like got a 1 ERA or something stupid like that. But outside of the top like 15 teams, people don't have dominant pitchers. And so to me, college softball is a lot more fun to watch than college baseball because it's much quicker. College baseball kind of takes forever. And college softball doesn't, and there's a lot more contact and a lot more balls put in play, unless you're playing like one of the top 15 teams who has a pitcher who throws a no hitter every third game.
If you're a member of the sports media, it goes without saying that faster is better.
I
remember the first time when I was like a Cub reporter and I was covering my first high school softball game. That thing was over in like 35 minutes. I was in and out. I couldn't be more thrilled.
So some of the baseball games I did a 15-inning game against Northwestern. I did like a nearly 4-hour game when UNLV used 10 pitchers in a 9-inning game and 4 in 1 inning. Softball, I had 2 softball games this year that were less than an hour and a half.
Oh, that's perfect.
And softball has an 8-run rule, so after 5 innings, if you're getting destroyed, the game's over. It's like there were 2 games this year where you had a walk-off hit that just made it an 8-run rule, and it's the greatest rule ever. So, college softball better than college baseball. Football is getting a transfer from Alabama, a running back who won't be eligible this year but next year. My favorite part about it is his name, which is Alti is his first name, and Tenpenny is his last name. I've got so many ideas for puns with his last name already. It's not even funny.
He's going to have to sit out a year before he's eligible.
I'm aware. Like, these are going to be, 18 months in the making.
You're storing up these puns for just future
it
use.
Is going to be so, like, I hope he is awesome glorious.
It's a long-term investment that you're making.
It's not like I'm not really investing anything, but some time. That's all it is. It's going to be glorious. Like, God, Tenpenny is such a great last name. Like, that is fantastic. Also, there were some other names. Apparently UNLV offered a kid basketball. I don't have any idea what year it is, but his last name is Popula.
Oh, Christian Popula Jr.
Yeah, I don't know who that is. I don't know what year he is. I don't even care. I just want him to come to UNLV so I can say Popula over and over.
His dad played for UNLV. Back in the day.
Oh, did he? Oh, my God. There was a Popula that... Oh, my God.
Yeah, and his dad is, like, a high school, like, scout now. He's a good follow on Twitter. He's, if you want to follow, like, West Coast recruiting and stuff, like, he's pretty good. I would definitely follow the dad.
Popula. I will. And I will just say his name to myself every time he tweets something. It'd be fantastic. All right. There is going to be some basketball in Curling the Stash. Schedule notes. John Rothstein tweeted out that UNLV will open the season with Cal Poly on November 13th this year. I have no clue how good Cal Poly is, but I assume they're not going to be any good. I don't think UNLV is going to need a Cody Doolin layup at the buzzer to tie or win the game, to win their opening game. Also, the Wichita State game has been moved back a week from December 2nd to December 9th. And I guess the important thing there is they have more time to recover after their trip to Maui, even though they were going to have 7 days as it was.
The only important schedule note for men's basketball next year is whether or not UNLV is going to end up playing Chaminade in the Maui Invitational. That's all I want to know.
That is the last Curling the Stash bullet point. Dantley Walker to Chaminade. I think some idiot named Mike Kramala broke that story. You broke it. It was breaking news. Very important.
Broke it in half.
Yeah, I guess. Before that, before knowing Dantley Walker was going to Chaminade, I would have been really disappointed if UNLV played Chaminade at any point in the Maui Invitational, because it'd basically be a pointless game. But, oh my God, I want it more than any game there. Like, I hope that's their first round game.
Am I crazy for being more excited about a possible Chaminade matchup in the Maui Invitational than I am for a possible like Kansas matchup, or you know, any of the other like high profile teams that they could face there?
No, like, it's perfect. Like, that's what I want to see.
Like a team that's willing to give Dantley Walker like 30 minutes against UNLV. Like he might score 0 points. You know, he might score 0 points. He might score 50 points. Like you just don't know, and that's kind of exciting.
Do you think Dave wants to play him?
I think if they played him, they would pay a little more attention to the scouting report than they otherwise would have against Chaminade. Like I definitely don't think that they want to get embarrassed by Dantley Walker. That's like the one team they won't let him step in, like dribble and just step in, walk into 35 footers. You know, they'll have to cover him everywhere across half court, which other teams might not do yet.
They'll have Pat McCaw face guarding him up the floor.
Yeah, like it's hard to explain to people who maybe didn't see him in practice without making it sound like hyperbole. But he would pull up from, and like literally pull up. He would just be dribbling in the half court, and then he would just shoot it from just obscene distances, like almost from the logo on the practice court, or on the logo on the practice court, which has got to be 30 plus feet. And he would make them, and Dave Rice would have to stop practice, and he would yell at people. And it was like, it really drove Dave Rice nuts when people would just let Dantley Walker shoot three pointers, no matter how far away he was. It's hard to say that without making it sound like hyperbole, but that was the case for 2 years. So
will the UNLV bench cheer for him when he shoots?
I mean, they love him, but I don't know if you can cheer for an opponent. But can you imagine Dave Rice's reaction if someone like loses focus in that game against Chaminade and Dantley drains like a 25 footer? Like that's got to be an immediate timeout, a stomp, and then you're yanked from the game, and some other 6'7" athlete is going in your place.
I hope. Like, UNLV wins 120-80, but Dantley drops 46. That would be tremendous.
Yeah.
I kind of feel like Dave would be happy if he won comfortably and Dantley still scored a lot of points, right?
I think that most people, the staff and everyone on the team, the entire program probably wishes him well. He's a good guy.
Yeah, so Dantley Walker to Chaminade. Do they have a TV package I can buy?
I don't know. I may have to convince my bosses to send me to Maui, even just to see that game.
Okay. All right. Dunks. We kind of talked about dunks, but Derek Jones, apparently he's at the Mendenhall Center at some point recently. And Jesus, if you follow him on Twitter, you've only seen him retweet 37 things about his dunks, videos of his dunks.
Can you blame the guy?
Not really, but Tyrell Ballot Green retweeted like everybody who mentioned his name on Twitter after he committed to UNLV. But so Derek Jones, there's one video of him dunking from the free throw line and doing a windmill simultaneously. Now, it's not like a full-on windmill, but it's like a 75% windmill.
I mean, it seemed like a windmill to me. It seemed like he got pretty much all of it.
Yeah, I mean, okay, I'm discrediting him when I shouldn't be, but I was just being descriptive. But yes, it's impressive. His foot was on the free throw line when he jumped too, so I'm gonna hate on him a little bit more.
Well, I've never seen anyone jump from behind. Have you ever seen anyone jump from behind the free throw line? They're usually on the line.
Yeah, it's but he like so he jumps and he dunks it, and it's a very impressive dunk, but somehow the part I'm most impressed by is that when he is, like, putting the ball through the rim, his feet are almost on the ground. Like, to me it's impressive just because he was able to jump for that long, and as he's coming down, he still has the complete control of everything to finish it right before he lands back on the ground. It's an awesome dunk.
Do you think that dunk will be good enough to win the Scarlet and Gray Showcase dunk contest? When they hold it in October.
People really, who's are we going to have judges, or is it like a fan who's the loudest?
Well, they didn't even have one last year. They didn't have a dunk contest.
Yeah,
I'm
aware.
I don't know. Do you think they've got to bring it back? Like this guy is,
Absolutely.
Him and Nuamu and
Like, he's tweeted out other videos. Like, there's one of him doing a 360 between the legs. Like, this is all just the stuff at Mendenhall. Like, he's done all his dunk contest stuff. But he does, like, a 360 between, goes between his legs. And the key to doing a 360 is turning before you actually jump.
Exactly. But, you do 320 of it while you're still on the ground.
Yeah.
And then he's got a slight turn midair.
He does one that somebody throws it off the side of the backboard for him, and he goes and gets it and puts it like between his legs and dunks it, and he does it so quickly. Like, he puts it between his legs, like it's incredibly quick how quickly he gets it down below his legs and back up and dunks it.
Is there a dunk that you want to see? Like, I'm sure that you watch dunk contests, you know, NBA dunk contests every year or whatever. And is there just some mythical dunk that you want to see?
No. I in terms of dunking, my favorite dunks are always dunking on people.
Yeah, well, in-game dunks are obviously the best.
Yeah. But no, I mean, I would rather see him dunk on somebody in practice than see him do some finesse, terrific move, just because, I don't know, like, that's just, to me, is way cooler if you can dunk on somebody, because then you can talk trash directly to somebody.
Yeah.
And can he do anything besides dunk? Because I have not seen anything about him besides, holy hell, he can dunk from the free throw line, which is tremendous, and I want him to start because I want to see that, but... Like, what does he do besides
dunk? He's supposed to be a pretty good slasher, like a guy who can, like...
So he can create his own dunk in the half court. That's good to know.
I would hope so. Like, he's supposed to be a guy that can sort of knife in through the lane and get to the basket and then do all the dirty work around the basket. Like, he's... someone was telling me that he's, you know, a good guy. He's going to get, you know, tip-ins, and he's going to grab offensive rebounds, and he's going to tip balls out and do stuff like that.
Oh, my God. I would so want to see him... tip slam over Chris Wood in practice just to see Dave Rice get mad. That would be great. I want to give you a chance, Mike, because two shows ago, maybe I asked you to rank the dunkers on the team, and you gave Ike the top spot over Derrick Jones, and it was Skylar Wilden on Twitter questioned you about that. After seeing his videos at Mendenhall, do you want to reorder your top three dunkers on UNLV's roster?
All I'm doing is paying respect to a veteran who's been in the game for a little bit longer than Derrick Jones. Like, Derrick Jones can dunk, no doubt about it, but Ike Nwamu's been dunking for a little bit longer. You know what I'm saying?
I know what you're saying.
I'm not saying if they have a dunk contest, you know, at the showcase, and you want me to put odds on it, I got to see a little bit more, but I got to go with the veteran for now. Like, Derrick Jones, like he says himself, he's never lost a dunk contest.
If there's a Scarlet and Gray dunk contest, Derrick Jones is like -2,000.
Yeah, he's way better than even money. Like, he's going to be the odds-on favorite.
Like, yeah, and it's any, like, you know, Ike, I think, would be your number two, or maybe Zimmerman, and they would be like, I don't know, +500 or something.
Let me ask you this. How many March Madness events has Derrick Jones participated in? Zero. How many has Ike Nwamu participated in? I don't know, but it's probably more than zero. I don't know how Mercer does it or his previous school, but if they have a March Madness, a Midnight Madness event, like he's got a little bit of experience there. Those bright lights come on, it's not so easy to dunk from the free throw line anymore.
Listen, I love Ike. He might unseat Pat McCaw as my favorite player on the team next year, but Derrick Jones is the best dunker on. He dunked from the free throw line, Mike.
He dunked from on the free throw line.
Okay, last part of the show. Mike is annoyed by something, and I think he's very annoyed. Oh. I think I'm surprised he was able to get through this podcast. Tom Brady has been suspended 4 games. Lifelong Patriots fan Mike Grimala, go ahead.
First of all, this is not UNLV related. I just want to preface it by saying I know no one wants to hear this. They won 4 Super Bowls. Like, you can't really complain.
No,
about
I want to hear it. I want to hear it. I feel bad for Tom Brady, Mike.
It's, first of all, if you look in the NFL rule book, the penalty for an equipment violation, whether it's intentional or not intentional, $25,000. It's a $25,000 fine. This season, this NFL season that was just recently completed, you had a game where the Minnesota Vikings and the Carolina Panthers were caught by television cameras warming up balls on the sideline. It was a cold game, an outdoor game. They were warming up balls on the sideline with a space heater. Indeed, do you know how many, you know, how many draft picks they were fined or how many players were suspended? Zero.
Nope.
You know why? Because no one cares about
is the Vikings.
No one cares about the balls. No one cares. No one could, before this happened, no one can tell you what the acceptable PSI is for a football. The refs, as laid out in the Wells report, the referees have overinflated balls on purpose just to tick off the players. So Brady, if they want to like let air out of the ball, like who cares? Like that is the if your quarterback was not getting the ball the way he likes it, there would be something wrong with him. I don't know. It's just an issue that no one cares about, but because it's the Patriots, it's got to be they've got to really go after him hard.
So one of the biggest criticisms of Roger Goodell since Ray Rice is that he just makes it up as he goes, and that's exactly what happened here.
Yeah, well, when it became the NFL is not a well-run organization from the PR and getting out in front of things. So when this I saw someone on Twitter I think say, what if this was the NBA of 5 years ago and the deflated balls came out the day after the AFC Championship game, David Stern would have made a sarcastic comment at a press conference and it would have been over. Because that's how the issue deserved to be treated. Like it's a non-issue, you just make it go away. But instead, they commission a gigantic investigation, an independent investigation that takes 4 months.
And didn't they pay that guy $100 an hour?
Yeah, and it becomes the investigation becomes so big that the NFL can't afford to let it fail. So once you start putting all that into it, you've got to find evidence against Tom Brady or against the Patriots, which is like you're letting the tail wag the dog at that point. Like if you read the Wells report without the final page, which is their findings and their conclusion, if you just read the report, you would think that there's nothing happened. Like there's nothing really that happened that you can prove. There doesn't seem to be any ill intent. The referees inflated the ball to 16 PSI. So Brady told the ball attendants to deflate it to 12.5 or to lower levels. That doesn't seem to be anything against the rules, but and the NFL doesn't even check the pressure before the games. Like the ref says that he checked the balls before the game, but did he use a gauge or did he just fail him with his hands? Like no one knows and no one cares. Like it's such a total non-issue. But once you start once you let it get out of hand and you let it become a huge issue, and then the fans are getting riled up and the media is getting riled up. And the media obviously does not like Bill Belichick. You can't. If I covered him, if you covered him, we wouldn't like him either. He's a jerk. So whenever you get a chance to lay into him, you're going to lay into him. So once all that stuff gets rolling, the tail is wagging the dog. You can't have that report come back and say, oh, nothing happened. So even though there was really no evidence, you write the conclusion saying, oh, it's more probable than not that he might have been aware of it, which seems like you're kind of couching your findings a little bit. It doesn't seem like a scientific conclusion to me, but oh well.
You feel better? You got to yell all that?
I feel like I'm raising my voice, but what are you going to do? I don't cover the Patriots. I'm allowed to be a fan. That's how I feel.
Okay, I got something on Twitter that I saw just recently. That annoys me and actually also is humorous. So CBS Sports College Basketball tweeted out a tweet. It says UNLV could be pretty fun next season. One of their players can dunk from the foul line, with a story that has the video of him, of Derek Jones dunking from the free throw line. Who the hell calls it a foul line?
I could see it if you say for redundant, if you're avoiding redundancy.
Oh, shut up with your redundancy. Learn how to
write. You
want to
be a good writer and you want to avoid redundancy. You can call it the foul line, charity.
But
charity stripe.
I can get behind charity stripe, but foul line implies that fouls happen at the line. Fouls don't happen at the line. Free throws happen at the line.
Call it a freebie.
No, okay. Foul line is stupid. But better than that are the replies. There are three replies to that, and all of them are people hating on it. The first one said, is that worth more points? ? The second one says, thankfully, defenses tend to prevent that sort of thing. And the third one says, that doesn't win you games, though. Loads of talent that always underachieves. That is tremendous hate on a kid that just dunked it from the free throw line.
Welcome to Twitter. I don't know what else. I don't know what else to say.
That is wonderful. The best thing on Twitter you just like Twitter search like UNLV and some other word, the amount of butthurt Kentucky fans. Oh my God.
Zimmerman?
Well, it's funny because there were so many Kentucky fans. They are mad at UNLV, Cal, because Cal got Ivan Rabb, and Mississippi State, because Mississippi State got Malik Newman. And they're just mad at all three of them because they're like, who would pick these crappy schools over Kentucky? And like three kids pick these crappy schools over Kentucky. And it's hilarious. Like, there was one tweet I saw, some guy was like, how many times is Mississippi State, Cal, and UNLV going to play on TV next year? Hashtag BBN, which is Big Blue Nation, if you don't know. And it's like, all of their games will be on TV? Like, UNLV doesn't play, like, what, four or five home games against crappy teams or online only. But the rest of their games are on TV. And Mississippi State, like, all of their games are going to be on the SEC Network or ESPN. U2, 3, whatever, and then Cat. Well, the Pac-12 Network sucks. So he kind of has a point there because the Pac-12 Network, like, you can't get it if you live on the other side of the Rocky Mountains or something stupid like that. So he kind of has a point there. But it's like the implication that only Kentucky plays on TV, and who would go? And oh God, there was somebody that said all three of them should go. They should go play basketball in Europe over instead of playing basketball at UNLV, Cal, or Mississippi State because. I think it was they would get more exposure and they would play better talent in Europe, which I don't know if either one is true, but if that's true, it's whatever. You're not going to play better. Kentucky and Mississippi State are in the same conference. They're going to play the same competition this year. It's tremendous how many Kentucky fans are just so pissed because they can't. They lost three guys to these crappy schools that they think are just awful.
Well, when you hit as many highly rated recruits as they have in recent years, I mean, the fans are going to get a little entitled.
It's tremendous though. Like it's the greatest thing I've seen on Twitter. I think is just the amount. Because like I just whatever I Twitter search with UNLV, somehow Kentucky fans end up in that Twitter search yelling about people not coming to Kentucky, and it's awesome. It's glorious, but. Anyway, don't call it the foul line. Don't call it the Mountain West Conference. It's not league.
Well, did you hear me earlier? I almost called it a league, but I corrected myself.
I didn't.
I called it a conference.
I'm not going to police that. Like, I'm not going to yell at anybody about it. It's just stupid because it's not a league. But anyway, also, update, Mike sent me a Snapchat of himself singing at the gym trying to force other people out.
And did it work or did it work?
Well, I mean, you sent me them leaving. They could have just been leaving because they were done working out. I don't know.
They were not leaving of their own volition, trust me.
But, yeah, it was under the impression that you forced them out with your vocal cords.
Yes.
Which is tremendous. So that is a real thing. But this has been the Towel Boys. There's one more roster spot, so maybe next week UNLV will have one more new player, and somehow it's May 11th, and we're still doing hour-long shows with brand-new information. I'm simply amazed. But this has been the Towel Boys. He's Mike Grimal over at runrev.com. I'm Tyler Bischoff here at Mountain West Connection. Thank you.